Many didn't even believe he would be able to finish. And in fact, he was rushed to a hospital for a major operation shortly after the trial's conclusion. I believe Rothman's troubles elicited further sympathy from the jury. I was part of the problem. As a witness, I was well-spoken and professional, I think, very much a contrast to Pete Rozelle. But that probably played into the NFL's hands. From day one, the NFL painted me as a vicious, greedy, Machiavellian billionaire, intent only on serving my selfish ends at everyone else's expense. The USFL, attorney Frank Rothman told the jury in his opening remarks, is controlled and dominated by Donald Trump, who can buy and sell many of the owners in the NFL. In truth, of course, the wealthy, powerful NFL owners cowered only to the extent that it served their ends. In retrospect, we might have been better off to put on the witness stand several of the smaller USFL owners who'd lost their shirts and had genuinely sad stories to tell. The other way the NFL beat us was in pure public relations. I've got to give this to Rozelle. He's always been great at promoting his league. His chief spokesman is a guy named Joe Brown, and Rozelle deserves credit for using him well. After each day's testimony, Brown would go to the halls and lobby the press masterfully, telling them what a great day it had just been for the NFL. It drove me crazy. I'd say to Harry Usher, our commissioner, "Why aren't you out lobbying the press?" And he'd say, "It isn't important. It's the jury we've got to convince." Unfortunately, that's not the way it works. Although the jury is instructed not to read any newspaper coverage or watch any television reports about the trial, it's nearly impossible to resist reading about a case you're part of, particularly one that's getting massive attention. Even if some jurors did resist, they undoubtedly heard about the trial coverage from their friends and family. Why else, after all, would Rozelle assign Joe Brown to lobby reporters every day for 6 weeks? For all that, when the jury finally began deliberations on July 25, 1986, I was convinced we made the more effective case, and that they'd find in our favor. What I never anticipated was that we could win and end up losing anyway. After 4 days of deliberation, the six-member jury concluded on July 29th that the NFL had violated antitrust laws by conspiring to monopolize professional football, and that they did illegally damage the USFL. But then they voted to award us only a token $1 in damages. It was a hollow victory. Without damages, the decision had no teeth, since the NFL didn't get punished for breaking the law. When the jurors were interviewed by reporters immediately after the verdict was announced, it turned out that they'd been deeply divided. At least two of them had wanted to award us substantial damages. One, a schoolteacher named Miriam Sanchez, had favored giving us damages of $300 million, but said that she'd misunderstood the mechanism for doing so. "I didn't understand the instructions," she told reporters, "so I had to put my faith in the judge, hoping he would give the USFL more money." I wasn't happy about the outcome, but in a way, I was relieved. My attitude is that you do your best, and if it doesn't work, you move on to the next thing. By the time the trial took place, I had lost quite a lot of money on the generals, and the USFL had lost many times my number. Without the prospect of a fall network television contract, there wasn't any point in investing more money. Most of my fellow owners agreed. 1 week after the decision, the USFL owners met and voted to suspend the season. At the same time, we voted to appeal the jury's ruling. Unfortunately, the fans come out the biggest losers. The NFL's monopoly power is secure again, and the owners have less reason than ever to consider adding new teams in cities that have long been seeking franchises. Meanwhile, the best USFL players have been picked up by NFL teams. Herschel Walker was signed by the Dallas Cowboys. Because I personally guaranteed Walker's contract, he could have collected $1.2 million from me for each of the next 6 years and never played football. But Herschel's a competitor, and the money was secondary. As it turned out, I made a very good deal with Dallas. They could have refused to pay for his big contract. But figuring that Dallas was under intense fan pressure to sign Herschel, I told them I was interested in letting Herschel go only if they picked up the full cost of his contract. Sure enough, they agreed. It was good for me, it was good for Herschel, and it's even turned out to be good for Dallas. Herschel joined the team in August, and although he had virtually no time to practice, he finished the season as the Cowboys' leading combined rushing and receiving yardage gainer. Jim Kelly also immediately became a star as quarterback for the Buffalo Bills. Freddie Gilbert, one of our defensive linemen, went to Atlanta and established himself as one of the team's best players. Even Doug Flutie, who everyone said was too small for the NFL, was signed by the Chicago Bears. Dozens of USFL players were signed to NFL contracts, and many have become stars on their new teams. Watching players like Herschel Walker and Jim Kelly play in the NFL does sometimes make me wish our league could have survived. I'm convinced that if the USFL had played last season, the Generals would have fielded one of the best teams in professional football. Not that I've ever given up entirely. I'm a big believer in comebacks, and the USFL is appealing this ridiculous verdict. In recent months, I've received numerous calls from a very smart, very persistent guy who is trying to put together an entirely new fall league. He wants me to take the New York franchise, and I'm seriously considering it. Chapter 12. Ice Capades. Rebuilding Woolman Rink. I never had a master plan. I just got fed up one day and decided to do something about it. On the morning of May 22, 1986, there was a story on the front page of the New York Times saying that New York City officials had decided to start all over in their effort to rebuild the Woolman skating rink in Central Park. If everything went well, said the city, the rink would be ready to reopen in approximately 2 years. I couldn't believe it. First of all, there was no reason to believe anything would go well, much less everything. The Woolman Rink, built in 1950, had first closed for renovations in June 1980. The work was scheduled to take 2.5 years. Even that seemed like a long time to rebuild an ice skating rink. Coincidentally, in June 1980, I broke ground for Trump Tower, a 68-story skyscraper with 6 floors of shopping, thousands of square feet of office space, and 263 residential apartments. 2.5 years later, we completed Trump Tower, on time and on budget. From my new apartment, I had a view of Woolman Rink. It was not a pretty sight. Although millions of dollars had already been spent on its renovation, it was obvious, even from a distance, that the rink was nowhere near finished. 3 more years passed, millions more dollars were spent, and things just got worse. So bad, in fact, that on this May morning in 1986, the city felt compelled to announce it was starting the whole process over from scratch. I knew absolutely nothing about building ice skating rinks, but I did know something about construction. If it took me 2.5 years to put up a major skyscraper, surely it was possible to build a $2 million ice skating rink in a matter of months. 2 years earlier, when the job was already a disaster, I'd called Henry Stern, Commissioner of Parks, and offered to take over construction from the city, for no fee. He turned me down. Now, after reading about this latest debacle, I called Henry again and repeated my offer. He had the same response. No thanks, he said. We can do it ourselves. That's great, Henry, I said. Except that you told me the same thing 2 years ago, and look what happened. I decided to write a very strongly worded letter to Ed Koch, the mayor of New York. I was appalled by the city's incompetence. I genuinely felt I could get the job done. And I believed the rink was something hundreds of thousands of New Yorkers, including my own children, had a right to enjoy. Whatever anyone may think, my motive was that simple. Dear Ed, my letter began, for many years I have watched with amazement as New York City repeatedly failed on its promises to complete and open the Woolman Skating Rink. Building the rink, which essentially involves the pouring of a concrete slab over coolant piping, should take no more than 4 months' time. To hear that after 6 years it will now take another 2 years is unacceptable to all the thousands of people who are waiting to skate once again at the Woolman Rink. I and all other New Yorkers are tired of watching the catastrophe of Woolman Rink. The incompetence displayed on this simple construction project must be considered one of the great embarrassments of your administration. I fear that in 2 years there will be no skating at the Woolman Rink, with the general public being the losers. Then I got to the real point. I am offering to construct and pay for a brand new Woolman ice skating rink and have it open to the public by November of this winter. I would lease the rink from the city at a fair market rental and run it properly after its completion. I sent the letter to Ed Koch on May 28, 1986. He wrote me a response by return mail. Somewhat to my surprise, he belittled my offer. The city wasn't about to let me operate the rink, he said, but they'd be delighted if I'd donate the $3 million to rebuild it and supervise the construction. He made a few more sarcastic comments and ended by saying, "With bated breath, I await your response." The tone of the mayor's letter irritated me. Fortunately, I wasn't the only one who was put off by it, and I have Koch himself to thank for that. I hadn't released my letter to the press because I didn't want to be accused of grandstanding. Koch, however, decided to release his letter. Apparently, he figured that if he made fun of my offer publicly, I'd just quietly slink away. He totally underestimated the press reaction. First, the press thrives on confrontation. They also love stories about extremes, whether they're great successes or terrible failures. This story had it all. Perhaps most important, many reporters tend to see themselves as consumer advocates. Almost nothing gets them as outraged as a boondoggle that victimizes average citizens. The city's fiasco at the Woolman Rink was an absolute classic. Even I was surprised at how totally the press took my side. Obviously, that doesn't always happen. But this time, within 3 days, there were dozens of articles and editorials attacking Koch for his reaction to my offer. "The Koch administration," said the Daily News in an editorial, "is hemming and hawing over Donald Trump's offer to rebuild and operate Woolman Rink in Central Park. Why? The offer is genuine, with no apparent strings attached. Koch should grab it and heave a sigh of relief that a long-running, costly disaster is off his hands. So far, the mayor has raised a lot of phony objections. Maybe the problem is that Koch and company are embarrassed that they've squandered $12 million on Woolman. Trump is offering to take over the Woolman project to rebuild the rink and to have it open by November at no cost to the city," wrote the New York Post. After the whole 13-year multi-million dollar debacle, you would think that they'd be jumping for joy. Not so. City officials seem more interested in thinking up reasons not to go forward than in making a deal. The city should give Donald Trump a speedy hearing. The Woolman farce has been running long enough. "Let him have a go at it," said Newsday. After all, the city has proved nothing except that it can't get the job done. If there's one thing I've learned from dealing with politicians over the years, it's that the only thing guaranteed to force them into action is the press, or more specifically, fear of the press. You can apply all kinds of pressure, make all sorts of pleas and threats, contribute large sums of money to their campaigns, and generally it gets you nothing. But raise the possibility of bad press, even in an obscure publication, and most politicians will jump. Bad press translates into potential lost votes, and if a politician loses enough votes, he won't get reelected. If that happens, he might have to go out and take a 9-to-5 job. That's the last thing most politicians want to do. What you have to understand about Ed Koch is that he's a bully, pure and simple. Bullies may act tough, but they're really closet cowards. The only people bullies push around are the ones they know they can beat. Confront a strong, competent person, and he'll fight back harder than ever. Confront a bully, and in most cases he'll fold like a deck of cards. Sure enough, the tide turned overnight. No sooner did the press jump on Koch's case than he reversed field completely. Suddenly, the city was virtually begging me to take on the Woolman-Rick job. On June 6th, I sat down in my office with city officials, including Henry Stern, to negotiate the terms under which I'd rebuild the Woolman-Rick. Until then, the city had insisted on competitive bidding, as is required on any city-financed construction job. I suggested a simple solution. I'd put up all of the money for the construction of the rink myself. In turn, I'd be reimbursed, over as many years as it took, from any profits the rink earned. In other words, I'd not only supervise construction, I'd also lend the city $3 million for an indeterminate period, and forever, if the rink didn't prove profitable. The city, in its infinite wisdom, balked. "There's no way we're going to allow that," city officials told me. "There's no way we're going to allow you to make a profit on the rink."
"No, you don't understand," I said. "If the rink does make money, I'll use it to reduce my loan. I'm not looking for personal profit. In fact, if I ever do get my money back, I'll give any subsequent profits to charity."
To my astonishment, and to the astonishment of my own lawyers, the city wouldn't budge. Instead, they came up with a counterproposal. I'd still put up the $3 million as a way of getting around the competitive bidding issue, but on the day I finished, the city would reimburse me in full. It's fortunate for those city officials that they chose to go into city government rather than business. The deal they were suggesting was far worse for the city than the one I'd originally offered. I wasn't about to fight them at my own expense. By the end of the day on Friday, June 6th, 10 days after my original offer, we came to an agreement, subject to final approval by the city's Board of Estimate. I'd put up the construction money and agreed to complete the work by December 15th. At that point, the city would reimburse me for my costs, up to a cap of just less than $3 million, but only if the rink worked. If I came in under budget, the city would pay me back only what I'd spent. If I went over budget, I'd cover the overruns myself. That much the city was graciously willing to let me do. I had just one challenge left: building the skating rink fast and building it right. If I failed, if I was even one day late or $1 over budget, my plan was to pack my bags and take the next plane to Argentina. There was no way Ed Koch or anyone else would ever let me live it down. Since I myself knew absolutely nothing about building rinks, I set out to find the best skating rink builder I could. Logic suggested that the best place to look was Canada. Ice skating is to Canadians what baseball is to Americans, the national pastime. The top builders, I figured, were probably the companies that built rinks for Canada's professional hockey teams. Sure enough, everyone I talked with agreed that a company called Kimco, based in Toronto, was the best of the best. Among other projects, they built a rink for the Montreal Canadiens. I got their top guy on the phone, and I began with a very basic question. What does it take to build a great outdoor skating rink? He gave me a very quick course in rink construction. The key choice, he said, was which ice-making system to use. The city had originally decided to use a relatively new technology in which the freezing agent is Freon. The rationale was that a Freon system requires less electricity, which translates into some minor energy cost savings. The disadvantage of the Freon system is that it's far more delicate, temperamental, and difficult to maintain, particularly in a public facility where personnel turns over frequently. Among ice skating facilities that use the Freon system, my friend from Kimco told me, at least one-third had experienced problems. The other option, which had been used in hundreds of ice skating rinks for decades, was a brine system, in which salt water is circulated through the pipes. It costs a little more to run than a Freon system, but the advantage is that it's highly reliable and incredibly durable. The Rockefeller Center skating rink has used a brine system since it opened in 1936 and has never experienced a major problem. By the time I finished my first call, I'd made up my mind to use a brine system in rebuilding the Woolman rink. The city, in fact, had finally come to the same conclusion. The only difference was that they first wasted 6 years and millions of dollars. I soon discovered that the city's incompetence on the Woolman rink project had extended to every imaginable detail, large and small. On June 16th, 1 week after I'd made my deal to take over rebuilding the rink, a city report was released on mistakes made at the Woolman rink over the past 6 years. The study had taken 15 months to complete, four times what I'd given myself to totally rebuild the rink. Worse yet, while the report provided endless examples of incompetence, it came to absolutely no conclusions about who was responsible for the fiasco and what could be done to avoid such failures in the future. The one thing the report did provide was an astounding chronology of sloppiness, indecision, incompetence, and sheer stupidity. If it weren't so pathetic, it would have been almost comical. The city first closed the rink for renovations in June 1980. By the time plans had been drawn and the bidding process completed, almost a year had passed. In March 1981, work finally began on installing approximately 22 miles of the very delicate, expensive copper piping used in a Freon cooling system. In the meantime, however, the Parks Department had second thoughts about where to locate the compressor room and what sort of refrigeration equipment to use. Even as the piping was being installed, all work was halted on the equipment that would eventually be needed to operate the rink's cooling system. Even if the ice-making equipment had been finished and installed, the design of the rink was such that it never had a chance of working. Specifically, the base of the rink was designed on a pitch, so that it was approximately 8 inches higher at one end than at the other. The pitch had a purpose. The fact that it ended up being 11 inches was an accident. The point of the pitch was that during the summer, the city hoped to use the rink as a reflecting pond, and apparently a pond reflects light better if its base is sloped. In the winter, however, that same sloped base would cause a problem. It doesn't take a genius to realize that when you try to make ice under those circumstances, there are only two possibilities. The better one is that ice will form, but that because the depth of the water varies, the consistency of the ice won't be uniform. The worse and far more likely result is that the water at the deeper end of the rink simply won't freeze at all, no matter how powerful the ice-making machinery. Even that issue soon became secondary. In July, 2 months after the laying of the pipes began, a torrential rain flooded the rink, depositing a thick layer of silt on the newly laid pipes. It wasn't until September that the Parks Department finally got around to hiring a crew to repair the damage. In the meantime, a new dispute had emerged within the Parks Department about how the concrete sidewalk surrounding the rink should be designed. The result was that the pouring of all concrete, including the concrete meant to form the rink's base, was held up 9 months while a debate over the sidewalk raged on. So, unfortunately, did winter. For 9 months, the newly laid delicate copper pipes were exposed to horrible weather. There were major snowstorms and flooding. In addition, because copper is quite valuable, vandals climbed over the fences and tried to cut off pieces of the pipe to resell. By the spring, it was as if those 22 miles of pipes had been through a war. Nonetheless, not one person thought to check them for possible damage. In June of 1982, 2 years after the rink was first closed, the concrete was finally poured over the untested copper pipes. Contractors often use a vibrating machine when they pour over uneven surfaces, since it helps prevent bubbles from forming. However, the vibrating had an unforeseen result. It began shaking loose the joints of the copper pipes. At the same time, the contractor had even bigger problems to contend with. He had underestimated by a great deal how much concrete it would take to cover the rink. The key to pouring concrete is to do it all at once, on a continuous basis, because that's the only way to ensure it will adhere and mesh uniformly. Rather than interrupt his pour, the contractor decided to dilute his concrete mixture with water. It was a recipe for disaster. Less than a week went by before cracks began appearing on the surface of the newly poured concrete slab. Not coincidentally, the cracks were concentrated at the end of the rink where the cement content had been diluted, and where the vibrating machine had been turned off. Delays in deciding where to locate the refrigeration equipment prompted another problem. By the time the city made its decision, after 16 months of deliberations, the contractor originally hired to install the equipment insisted on a modification of his original agreement. Specifically, he demanded more money. Those negotiations took another 12 months, and it wasn't until July 1983 that the city approved a new contract on the contractor's terms. The completion date on installation of the refrigeration equipment was pushed forward yet again to September 1984. In the late fall of 1984, the system was finally tested for the first time. It proved unable to sustain pressure for long enough to create ice because it turned out that there were leaks in the pipes beneath the concrete slab. Between October and December of 1984, 6 leaks were found and repaired. No luck. The system was tested again and still couldn't make ice. It was at that point that I called Henry Stern and made my first offer to take over construction of the rink. When he turned me down, I said, "Listen, would you like to walk over together and take a look, and perhaps I can at least make some suggestions?" A few days later, in the dead of winter, we walked over to the rink. I was shocked by what I saw. There were literally hundreds of tiny cracks in the concrete slab. Worse than that, there were at least a dozen huge gaping holes cut into the slab at various places. When I inquired, I found out that the holes had been cut through the concrete in order to get at the leaks in the pipes underneath. Unfortunately, the jackhammers used to make holes in concrete are very violent, and the pipes underneath are very delicate. In the effort to get at the leaking pipes, these violent men with their violent jackhammers actually made the problem much worse. Right then and there, I turned to Stern and said, "You have a major problem. You'll never find these leaks. In the meantime, you'll just create bigger leaks. Forget it. Start all over." Henry tried to be polite, but it was clear that starting over was the last thing he'd consider. In the spring of 1985, the city came up with a wonderful new idea. At a cost of $200,000, they hired an outside engineering consultant to study why Freon was leaking from the pipes and to recommend solutions. The firm promised to have its report within 4 months. 9 months later, in December 1985, the firm announced that they'd been unable to isolate the cause of the leaks. Nearly 6 years had now passed since the Woolman Rink was first closed for renovations. Nearly $13 million had been spent on the effort. The Parks Department finally concluded that the Freon system would have to be scrapped and replaced by a brine system. On May 21, 1986, they announced a new $3 million renovation plan and the 18-month timetable. That was when I finally convinced the city to let me take over. By mid-June, when the Board of Estimate approved the deal I'd negotiated with the city, I had already begun work. One thing I discovered was that the city had agreed to pay a $150,000 fee to yet another consulting company, this time to provide recommendations about how to build the rink with a brine system. The city's contract specified that the company, St. Ange Rough Associates, SORA, would begin work on July 1, 1986, and deliver its report by the end of December. In other words, I had agreed to finish rebuilding the rink before the city was scheduled to get the report on how it ought to be done. On the off chance that the consultants might have some intelligent suggestions, I decided to sit down with them. I probably shouldn't have been surprised by what I discovered. The two gentlemen who ran the firm were specialists in refrigeration, but had never before been involved in building a skating rink. They hadn't the faintest idea what it entailed. So much for their help. I hired Kimco to build the refrigeration and piping equipment for the system and to advise me generally. To build the rink itself, I hired HRH, the construction company that had already built the Hyatt and Trump Tower for me and had proved themselves high-quality general contractors. In this case, they generously offered to do the work at cost. Meanwhile, Chase Manhattan, with whom I had a long banking relationship, stepped forward and offered to lend all the money for construction, again, at no profit. It was the sort of project everyone could relate to and appreciate. When I went to see the rink, things were even worse than I'd imagined. For example, there were gaping holes in the roof of the skater's house, and the result had been massive water damage to the interior of the building. But even the smaller things I noticed reflected the city's approach to the job. For example, as I walked into the rink, I came upon a row of canvas sacks, abandoned and half covered by weeds. When I looked inside, I discovered that the sacks were filled with plants, which were once intended to be part of the new landscaping. Instead, they'd been left on the ground, unopened, and had died. Just as I was making this discovery, a city worker walked by and stepped right on one of the few living plants on the site. He didn't look back. In a way, it was a perfect metaphor. The rink being trampled by one of the people who was being paid to fix it. The incident reminded me of a time, several years earlier, when I was walking by the rink on a beautiful summer day. It was about 2 in the afternoon, and there, right in the middle of the unfinished rink, were perhaps 30 laborers. Not one of them was working. I figured they were on coffee break. Perhaps an hour later, I walked past the rink again. The same men were there in exactly the same positions, as if they were on a permanent siesta. I didn't fully realize the implications of the scene at the time. Now I saw it as a symptom of the bigger problem at Woolman Rink. There was absolutely no one in charge. Leadership is perhaps the key to getting any job done. There wasn't a single day when I didn't check on the progress we were making on the rink. Most days, I visited the site personally. I'd given myself 6 months to finish, and based on the city's record, meeting that deadline would be a minor miracle. By my own calculations, however, 6 months actually left me a cushion of a month, in case anything significant did go wrong. If absolutely everything went right, I felt it was possible we'd finish the job in 4 months. One of the first decisions we made was to build the new rink on top of the old one, rather than rip it out altogether. By the 1st of August, we were able to lay a level sub-base for the new rink, on top of which we would install the piping and pour the concrete for a flat-bottomed rink. Kimco was busy building 2 huge 35,000-pound refrigeration units. I hadn't realized, when I offered to take on the job, how big Woolman Rink actually is. At nearly 3/4 of an acre, it is one of the largest man-made skating rinks in the country. Even before we began construction, we were besieged by calls from the press, seeking progress reports. Reporters who normally had no interest whatsoever in construction suddenly wanted to know the smallest details about the laying of pipe, the pouring of concrete, and the building of a compressor room. After the first dozen or so calls, I decided to hold a press conference to answer everyone's questions in a single forum. On August 7th, with only the subfloor in place, we met the press at the rink. To my surprise, perhaps 3 dozen reporters, photographers, and cameramen showed up, including representatives from every local television station and both wire services. I had no earth-shaking news to announce. All I could report was that everything was proceeding right on schedule, and that we expected to be open by December. That was enough. The next day, there were stories in every newspaper with headlines like, "Trump has an ice surprise for skaters," and "Trump puts the icing on Woolman cake." There were those who said I went a little overboard holding press conferences about Woolman Rink. Perhaps they're right. But I can only say that the press couldn't get enough of the story. At least a dozen reporters showed up for every press conference we held. Nor did the story of the rink generate just local attention. Dozens of newspapers as far away as Miami, Detroit, and Los Angeles ran long pieces about the Woolman rink saga. Time magazine devoted a full page in its Nation section to the story. It was a simple, accessible drama about the contrast between governmental incompetence and the power of effective private enterprise. From September 7th through 10th, we laid 22 miles of pipes. On September 11th, a convoy of cement trucks arrived and we began a continuous pour that lasted 10 hours. There was no shortage of cement. The next day, when the engineers checked to see how evenly the pour had turned out, it was perfectly level. On September 15th, the newly built refrigeration equipment was installed in the renovated compressor room. The only obstacle left was the heat. On the day we poured the concrete, the temperature climbed to 87 degrees. It occurred to me that we were going to be ready for skaters before the weather was ready for us. By the end of September, all of our ice-making equipment was in place. All we needed to test our system was a succession of 4 days during which the temperature stayed below 55 degrees. Instead, for 2 weeks, one beautiful, unseasonably warm day followed another. For the first time in my life, I found myself wishing for winter. Finally, on October 12th, the temperature dropped below 55, and it stayed down for several days. On October 15th, we conducted our first test of the new system, sending brine through the piping. There were no leaks, and the pressure held. That night, following a rainfall, ice formed on the rink. Beautiful, clear, long-awaited ice. It was almost 4 months to the day since I'd gotten approval to renovate the rink. We'd also managed to come in more than $750,000 under our $3 million budget. With the city's blessing, we used the leftover money to renovate the adjacent skatehouse and restaurant. During most of the construction, the city stayed out of our way, in large part because I instructed my men to keep park officials off the site. When they did try to interfere, it invariably turned into disaster. As an example, after we'd finished the rink, a crew from the Parks Department showed up carting a small tree, which, they announced, the city wanted to plant in my honor. It wasn't enough for one or two guys to handle the job. A crew of perhaps a half dozen men came, among them a park horticulturist, to supervise the job. The tree itself was transported in a tractor with a backhoe loader. By total coincidence, I walked up to the rink just as the men were beginning to plant the tree. It happened to be one of the ugliest, scrawniest little trees you're ever likely to see. I could have lived with that. What got me absolutely nuts was the way they were planting the tree. Just the previous day, we planted beautiful specimen sod all around the perimeter of the rink. It had rained the night before, and the ground under the newly planted grass was soft. What do these men do but drive their tractor right over the new grass, completely trampling it? In a matter of minutes, these six men, most of whom weren't needed in the first place, managed to totally destroy a beautiful planting job that had taken 2 days to complete and now would require 3 months to grow back in. Around this time, I got a letter from Gordon Davis, the Parks Commissioner before Henry Stern. Davis wrote to say that as the person primarily responsible for the early problems at the rink, he was delighted and relieved to see how superbly his mistakes had been corrected. I happen to believe that Davis was far from the only person responsible. But what struck me most about his gracious attitude was how radically it contrasted with that of Henry Stern. Throughout the Woolman Project, Stern took numerous opportunities to minimize to reporters what we were accomplishing. The Daily News, noting one particular snide comment Stern made, snapped back in an editorial. "Try saying thanks, Henry," they wrote. "It's more dignified under the circumstances." Koch himself was not exactly effusive about what we'd accomplished. Again,
I think the media may have been a factor. In October, all the local newspapers ran stories that surely must have made him a little defensive. The Times, for example, ran a lead editorial that began, "New York City bungled the job of reopening Woolman Skating Rink for 6 years, wasting millions," and ended by saying, "The lessons of the Woolman Rink ought not to be forgotten." Whenever they were asked, both Koch and Stern told reporters that after the job was done, the city intended to meet with me and my people to see whether the lessons of Woolman Rink could be applied to other city projects. If I heard them make that statement once, I must have heard it a dozen times, including in several speeches on November 13th, the day we officially opened the rink to the public. I've yet to get a call from any city official seeking a meeting. I can't honestly say I'm surprised. The bad press has died down, and that's all any of them were really concerned about. Still, I believe there are some lessons the city could take away from what we accomplished at Woolman Rink. At one point, Koch offered his own explanation for why we were able to do what the city could not. "Trump put in a cushion," Koch said, "and then he was able to reduce it by working as hard as he could with an elite crew, who knew that if they screwed up the job, they would never work for Donald Trump again." That explanation wasn't totally wrong. What Koch didn't understand is that the city could have done some of the very same things I did. I'm not suggesting they would have been able to complete the job in 5 months as I did, or even in 6 months. But there is no conceivable excuse for not completing it in a year, much less for failing for 6 years. That's incompetence, plain and simple. And incompetence was at the heart of this whole sad saga. City officials invariably cite two reasons why they can't move as quickly as private developers. The first is that by law, the city must award any contract to the lowest bidder, regardless of whether that person is best qualified to do the work. There is at least a partial solution. Objective qualifying standards ought to be adopted for any bidder on a city job. Provable past performance, for example, should be required across the board. In addition, any contractor who does good work for the city, coming in on time and on budget, ought to be given priority on future city jobs. The other disadvantage city officials cite is the so-called Wicks Law. It requires that on any public construction job budgeted over $50,000, the work must be divided among at least four separate contractors. The law was designed to increase competition and reduce building costs, but it does just the opposite. No single general contractor is permitted to have overall responsibility, and the result is frequent delays, disputes, and overruns. I don't deny that these laws put a crimp on the city, but I believe a far bigger problem is leadership. I know from my own experience that the only way to get even the best contractor to finish a job on time and on budget is to lean on him very, very hard. You can get any job done through sheer force of will and by knowing what you're talking about. As it is now, a contractor will come in and say to a city official, "I'm sorry, but we've run into this problem, and we're going to need another $1 million or $2 million to finish the job." No one argues back, because virtually no one in city government knows anything about construction. Worst of all, no one in the city government bureaucracy is held accountable for failure. I'll give you what I consider the classic example. Back in 1984, by which time the city had already spent 4 years trying to rebuild Woolman Rink, a man named Bronson Binger held a press conference. At the time, Binger's title was Assistant Parks Commissioner, and his primary responsibility was the renovation of Woolman Rink. Binger made a bold, confident announcement to the reporters who showed up. "If the Woolman isn't ready to reopen in time for next season," he told them, "then he'd resign his job." A year passed. The rink obviously didn't reopen, and Binger was true to his word. He resigned. There was just one catch. A short time later, he was named deputy commissioner in charge of prison construction for the state of New York. I don't know much about building prisons, but one thing is certain. Renovating ice rinks is a lot easier.
You don't reward failure by promoting those responsible for it, because all you'll get is more failure. The one group that does benefit from the city's incompetence are the contractors who do the work. When a subway project or a new highway or a bridge goes over budget by millions of dollars, contractors clean up. You won't read the names of these people on the Forbes 400, and they may not all speak perfect English, but I'll guarantee you this. Many of them have become immensely wealthy working for New York City. They earn vast sums from huge, unwarranted cost overruns that city officials approve and taxpayers underwrite. The gala opening celebration for the rink was produced by former skating champions Dick Button and Aya Zanova Steindler. They managed to bring together for one show most of the world's best skaters. Peggy Fleming, Dorothy Hamill, Scott Hamilton, Debbie Thomas, Robin Cousins, Tyler Cranston, the teams of Torval and Dean, and Blumberg and Siebert, and others. It was a great occasion. Had the city then turned over the finished rink to a second-rate operator, this story might still have a bad ending. But because normal competitive bidding would have led to a new delay in opening the rink, the city asked me to operate the rink on a temporary basis for the first season. Again, I just looked for the best rink managers available. The answer I came up with was Icecapades. Besides doing great ice shows, Icecapades operate some of the best rinks in the country. They've done an impeccable job with Woolman Rink. It's not only beautifully run, it's been highly successful. During the 1970s, when the rink was still open and run by the city, it earned an average gross of approximately $100,000 a year and never took in more than $150,000. Although we charged prices below those of any private city rink, $4.50 a session for adults, $2.50 for children, we earned $1.2 million in revenues during our first season. Profits exceeded $500,000 after expenses, and all of it went to charity and the Parks Department. But equally important, more than 500,000 skaters enjoyed the Woolman Rink. Even now, as I write this in the spring of 1987, I get a real kick every time I look out the window of my living room in Trump Tower and see hundreds of skaters on the Woolman Rink. However, I won't be one of them. People have been waiting for years to watch me fall, but I'm not about to help the cause. Skating isn't my strong suit. Chapter 13. Comeback. A West Side Story. The toughest business decision I ever made was giving up my option on the West Side Yards, 78 riverfront acres between 59th Street and 72nd Street, in the summer of 1979. The easiest business decision I ever made was buying back those same 100 acres in January 1985. I have a tendency to get very enthusiastic about any deal I make, but I suspect few people would argue that those 100 acres represent the single best undeveloped piece of property in America today. It has been reported that I paid $95 million for the West Side Yards, or about $1 million an acre, which is not far from the correct figure. Taking the time value of money into account, I paid less to purchase the site in 1985 than I would have if I'd exercised my option to buy them in 1979. During the intervening years, the price of most Manhattan real estate increased as much as 5 times. Even before I put up a single building, I'm certain I could sell the property at a very substantial profit, and I've turned down numerous offers already. Consider just one comparison. Very shortly after I bought the West Side Yards, another group of developers paid approximately $500 million for the Columbus Circle Coliseum site, a tiny property by comparison, and just 4 blocks away. I got the yards at a great price, because a bank was foreclosing on a desperate seller, because I made the deal before the property was offered for sale on the open market,
and because I was one of the few developers both willing and able to pay millions of dollars a year in carrying costs for as long as it took to get the yards developed. Securing the option to purchase the West Side Yards from the Penn Central Railroad back in 1974 was the first major deal I made in Manhattan. At the time, as I've said, the city was on the verge of bankruptcy, and the West Side was hardly considered a great place to invest. But I had a simple conviction. I couldn't go very wrong buying spectacular riverfront property in the middle of Manhattan at a bargain basement price. Over the next 5 years, however, government subsidies dried up for the kind of middle-income housing I was proposing. Community opposition to any development on the West Side reached a fever pitch, and banks remained reluctant to finance any large-scale developments. Perhaps most important, I was launching other projects, among them the Commodore Hyatt, Trump Tower, and my first Atlantic City casino. Nor was I eager to load myself down with huge carrying costs while my personal resources were still very limited. By devoting myself to other deals instead, I generated a cash flow large enough to support the carrying costs on virtually any project. I also built a record of success that made banks happy to lend me money for nearly any deal. Shortly after I gave up my original option in 1979, the Penn Central sold the West Side Yards to my friend Abe Hirschfeld. Very quickly, Abe went out and got himself a partner on the deal. Francisco Macri became wealthy in the 1960s building bridges for the government in his native Argentina. Under the deal with Hirschfeld, Macri agreed to take over the job totally. Hirschfeld retained a substantial percentage of profits, but no ongoing role in the project. Macri, in turn, gave the job of overseeing the project day to day to a man named Carlos Varsavsky, a former physics professor who'd been running Macri's Argentinian company, BA Capital. The Macri team had plenty of brain power. What they lacked was practical experience, especially in New York City, where it is so difficult to do any sort of real estate development. The first key to developing any huge Manhattan site is getting the necessary approvals to build a job that is economically viable. Rezoning is a complex, highly political, and very time-consuming process that ultimately involves a dozen city and state agencies, as well as local community groups and politicians. Macri did finally manage to get his zoning for the project he named Lincoln West. But in the process, he made far too many concessions to the city. Being forced to sell out may have been the best thing that ever happened to him. If Macri had ever tried to build a project under the terms to which he'd agreed, he would have lost hundreds of millions of dollars. It was sad, in a way, because Franco Macri is a wonderful and well-meaning man. But he made a critical misjudgment from the start. He assumed that in a project as big as the West Side Yards, he could afford to absorb nearly any costs and still end up with a huge profit. The truth is that unless you design a project to be self-supporting as you build it, you risk getting eaten alive before you've turned the corner into profit. One of Macri's problems was that he tried to apply the principles of bridge building to a residential development. When you build a bridge under contract to the government, you calculate the costs and sign a contract for a set amount. All you need to do to earn a profit is bring the project in on budget. In developing real estate, it's a whole different ballgame. You can budget building costs, but you can't truly project revenues, because you're always at the mercy of the market. The variables include how much you get per unit, how long it takes to sell out, and what your carrying costs are along the way. The less you commit to spend up front, the less you're at risk later. Instead, Macri spent 3 years mostly in the business of giveaways. The city, eager to get all it could in return for approving the project, asked Macri for concession after concession. Macri began by agreeing to provide $30 million to refurbish the 72nd Street subway station nearest to the project, even though the projected renovation amounted to little more than widening a single platform by 4 feet. For $30 million, you ought to be able to totally rebuild a station. Next,
Macri threw in a $5 billion pledge for a railroad flat car operation in the South Bronx to replace the one he'd be eliminating in the West Side Yards. Then he promised to chip in $30 million for a public park within his development. Later, he agreed to build a new public through street connecting with the existing city grid, a job that would have surely cost tens of millions of dollars. When Con Edison asked Macri to underwrite the cost of rebuilding a smokestack the company owned on the site, he even agreed to that. This I found particularly preposterous. Con Edison already gets one of the highest utility rates in the country. When I met Macri, I asked him why he'd agreed to do anything for Con Ed. Wasn't it enough, I asked, that over the years he was going to be buying billions of dollars worth of electricity from them? They told me they were going to oppose my project, Macri explained. And anyway, what's the big deal? How much can a smokestack cost? Suddenly I understood. Franco Macri hadn't bothered to check, but I did. To put a needle 500 feet into the air, it turns out, costs nearly as much as putting up a building. It could run to $30 or even $40 million, I told Macri. He still didn't seem fazed. By the time he'd finished being generous to anyone who asked, Macri had committed more than $100 million in giveaways. Worse yet, he'd agreed to pay in full for much of it before he'd erected any buildings, much less sold a single apartment. Equally bad was the zoning to which Macri finally agreed. By the time the process was finished, he'd been negotiated down to less than 4,300 residential units on his 100-acre site, a density lower than you find in some 6-story apartment complexes in the suburbs. More specifically, Macri agreed to build just 850 units in the most valuable part of his site, 68th Street to 72nd Street, which was adjacent to an existing residential neighborhood. The great majority of his apartments he agreed to put in the undeveloped industrial southern end of the site, where the residential market remained totally untested. Anti-development forces on the Upper West Side barely had to fight with Macri. He became his own worst enemy. The last major mistake Macri made was that he never set out to create any excitement about his Lincoln West project. During the 4 years when he owned this terrific piece of property, virtually not a word was written about it. Even the name Lincoln West implied that, despite the fact that this represented one of the largest and potentially most important developments in the United States, it was merely a job located west of Lincoln Center. An average 150-unit luxury high-rise building in New York takes 2 years to sell out, and that assumes a strong market and good promotion. To sell literally thousands of units in a new development requires that you have both something unique to sell and a very aggressive approach to selling it. Macri had neither. The Lincoln West development he had proposed, 24 relatively short brick buildings, was as bland and uninspiring as any of a dozen public housing projects that were thrown up around Manhattan during the 1960s. It was scarcely surprising that not one of at least a dozen banks Macri called on over 3 years was willing to lend him money for his construction, even though banks were practically throwing money at dozens of other New York City developments. By late 1983, Macri also had personal cash problems. The war in the Falklands apparently had hurt his business interests in Argentina. By this point, counting outlays for architectural staff, environmental impact studies, and carrying costs, Macri was probably into Lincoln West for more than $100 million. Caught in a crunch, he began defaulting on the original loan he'd taken from Chase Manhattan to purchase the land. In the spring of 1984, I got a call from Abe Hirschfeld. He told me that Macri was in trouble and was interested in selling. I went to see Macri, and we began a long negotiation. He was eager to get out with a profit. At the same time, the bank was breathing down his neck. Sure enough, in November, we finally agreed to an all-cash price of approximately $100 million, and Chase agreed to finance a good part of the transaction. One of the reasons Franco Macri agreed to sell to me, I'm convinced, is that I'd done him a favor long before we finally made a deal.
Shortly after our first meeting in early 1984, we agreed on the terms of a tentative deal under which Macri would sell me the project. He wasn't yet certain that he wanted to sell, but he was willing to consider signing at least a